This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In the West, the study of the phenomenon known as the Crusades has long been dominated by European concerns, European periodization, European selection of important moments and personages, and, most of all, European sources. In recent years, scholars such as Carol Hillenbrand, Paul Cobb, and Michael Lower have mined Arabic language material with the purpose of creating a more balanced view of the Crusades, one that gives the Muslim experiences a voice in the English language. Now, Dr. Suleiman Murad, professor of religion at Smith College, and Dr. James Lindsay, professor of history at Colorado State University, have produced an anthology known as Muslim Sources of the Crusader Period. Covering a wide range of topics and a diverse set of sources, Muslim Sources of the Crusader Period makes new translations of primary source material available to English-speaking students and scholars of the Crusades. In our conversation, Jim, Suleiman, and I touch upon how the Crusades are perceived differently in Muslim sources than they are in European sources, how to categorize an anthology and what sort of sources to include, and the importance of establishing the diversity of opinion, even within the Muslim sources. I am one of your co-hosts, Dr. Aaron Hagler from Troy University, and thank you for listening to the New Books in Middle Eastern Studies podcast. Now to our topic. Welcome, Jim and Suleiman, to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, and thank you very much for joining us. Your anthology, Muslim Sources of the Crusader Period, seeks to fill a gap in the scholarship of the Crusades, pointing out that, in general, scholarship of the Crusades in English tends to be dominated by European sources. You've set about translating a wide array of Muslim sources and collected them in this volume with the purpose of making them available to students and scholars of the Crusades who do not themselves read Arabic. But before we get to the book itself, I'd like you each to say something about your own academic journeys. What brought you to studying the Crusades in general? So, Suleiman, if you wouldn't mind, we could start with you.
Thank you so much, Ari, for having us on your program. My journey has been very, very long. Started back when I was undergraduate student at the American University of Beirut. At that time, I was studying mathematics. And I took a few courses in Middle Eastern history, and the topic really excited me tremendously. Part of my own essentially questions were related to the political reality of the Arab-Muslim world at the time when I was growing up. So I wanted to find answers for that. And when you study the modern period, soon you realize you can't understand it properly until you study the pre-modern period. And when you go to the pre-modern period, you realize you cannot understand it properly unless you study the medieval period. So it became like a domino effect backward. Mm-hmm. Anyway, accidents made me focus part of my work on the period around the Crusades. I start reading both scholarship and novels about it. And actually, I became very, very excited about it, interested in it, realizing its complexity. And everything, as the pun goes, is history from there.
Very good. I totally relate to how one thing leads to another. It almost feels like you're trying to scrabble your way out of quicksand, and you just keep getting pulled in deeper and deeper and deeper as you realize you need to go back further.
Indeed, indeed. And when I got essentially to late antique, started studying Syriac, the origin of the Quran, the world from which Islam came, I also realized you have to dig deep into pre-modern, the period before late antique, into ancient Iran, into the Greco-Roman world. And there I said, I can't do it. the good thing about Islamic studies generally is Arabic can carry you a long way to go. Persian helps, Syriac a little bit, but once you start going back in time, you need the expertise of certain languages, and that becomes very complicated. So I stopped there, and I came back, reoriented myself into partly the Crusader period and partly the period that is about the formation of Islam and how both are being remembered today.
Very good. Thank you. And Jim, to you, same question.
Mine's a little almost the reverse, but it's completely haphazard as well. I grew up, my dad was a preacher, and so I grew up on, you know, Bible stories and Bible characters, and those people were real life people in my imagination. And, you know, President Johnson was just the president. He didn't really matter in my mind, my world, when I was a little kid. So when I finished college, I was a history major. I wanted to do ancient Near East and biblical studies and that kind of thing. I had an opportunity to go to the Hebrew University, and I intended to do that there in Jerusalem. And I took a class with Yochanan Friedman because I was, you know, on Islamic history. I thought I should learn something about it since I was in the neighborhood, and ultimately ended up shifting from ancient Near East and Hebrew as my primary language to early Islam and Arabic. So I kind of got into it in a haphazard way, but I started out with an interest in the way back. And like Suleiman said, there was too many languages that I would have to know to really do well in that. And it's also, I think the ancient world is a little bit more well-trodden than what Suleiman and I and what you do. There's a lot more opportunity to do things that are new in this part of the world or this part of history. So I found a home in this part, but it also allows me to do, particularly where this book is on the Crusader period. You're still dealing with Judaism, Christianity, and Islam and interactions in a very vibrant period. And so that's I draw on my earlier interests very much, but my primary focus is in this time frame.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you both very much. So let's get right into it, to the book. Can you talk about, either one of you, why you felt this anthology was a necessary one at this point?
I guess I'll jump in. The part of the need for the anthology grew out of our earlier project, which was more of a heavy-duty scholarship project where we worked on We did an Arabic edition and English translation of a jihad manual by Ibn as-Sakr, a Damascene historian. And we found that to be quite enjoyable. But we also found, since we both had taught courses on the Crusades, that the stuff that's available in English from the Islamic side, it was limited. And we thought that since we enjoyed working together on that other project, we'd try our hand at this. And that would be my version of how we got into it. But I think every teacher has their books that they really enjoy using and other ones that they use because it's the only thing available, but you're not very satisfied with it. And I think dissatisfaction with what was available is one of the motivators, and an opportunity to put together something that, you know, that we ourselves would want to use in class, and hopefully our colleagues in the field will agree with us.
Okay.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I add one thing to illustrate the point that Jim raised just now. That's largely the dissatisfaction was the source available sources in English. When you teach, you soon realize the limitation of the sources that are available for you to give the student a realization and understanding about how complex the world of the Crusades was, especially the Muslim-Crusader interactions. Hence, we felt we need to look at a variety of examples in order to fill that lacuna that we couldn't find in English.
Sure. So there's obviously a bunch of Muslim works on the Crusades. I mean, the corpus is obviously quite vast. And so you're looking to, I guess, fill a gap. What considerations went into your selection of sources? I know one thing that you mentioned in there was that you were not going to include stuff that was already available in English. So maybe these are either lesser known or for whatever reason haven't been translated yet. But yeah, what considerations went into your selection of sources? And then secondary question, within specific sources, how did you decide where to begin your selections and where to end them, how to frame the specific selections?
Wow, that's a really good question. Well, some of this, I mean, not everything in here has not been translated. I mean, there are certain things that you simply can't avoid including, but we did our own translations because we wanted it to flow a little more smoothly. I would say my biggest dissatisfaction with the stuff that was available, it was heavily based on chronicles, and it tends to be heavily based or focused on Saladin and Richard in the Third Crusade, that period. And we wanted to illustrate that what we call the Crusader period is a chronologically much larger area. And also to convey the idea that from the point of view of the Muslim actors, the Crusades are not necessarily anything new, but they're sort of like the latest phase in an ongoing story. And so in choosing the sources, we wanted to bring to light to students and colleagues as many voices as possible. You know, disparate kinds of voices. So we have, you know, we have poetry, we have, of course, chronicles, but we have religious texts, we have geographical texts, we have inscriptions to demonstrate to the reader the breadth of what's available and what scholars and students can use to understand this period more in its complexity a little bit better.
When you say go ahead, Suleiman.
I'm just completing this excellent thought that Jim contributed to say that indeed the complexity and the diversity of the sources, of the Muslim sources, is a matter of great richness for the student of Crusader history. But I want to go back to a point that you raised, Ari, at the beginning, that largely Crusader historiography is determined on the basis of European agendas. I don't necessarily say this in any negative way, in as much as European history hegemonizes the way the story of the Crusades is told, including what Muslim sources are identified as interesting to read. And here, when you are a European historian, you want to look at who was the interlocutor of Richard the Lionheart, who was the interlocutor of St. Louis the Ninth. You identify specific people or specific periods, and you go look what was the Muslim reaction to that. That is not how the Muslims saw the Crusades. So if you really want to pay attention to what the Muslims said and how they perceived of this phenomena that we call the Crusades, you need to look at the Muslim sources without this kind of prejudice. You have to open yourself to all kinds of literature that the Muslims produced at the time, where they commented in one way or another, whether it is direct or indirect, about the Crusader period and about the challenges that they were facing. And then you can get a good understanding of Islamic reaction to the Crusades rather than come to it from a European perspective.
So if you were going to summarize the major differences between the Muslims' views of the Crusades versus the European views of the Crusades, what would you say are the major differences? I mean, not just who are the good guys and the bad guys, but, you know, the periodization and maybe some of the geography about where the Crusades were happening. What are the key differences you would want people to take away?
Oh, you're asking good questions here, Ari. I'm gonna let Suleiman respond to that one while I think a little bit.
that's a trick, Jim. You are throwing me under the bus first. Anyway, what I look at for this specific question is that the Muslims largely. Talking here about the historians who wrote about the period, they were writing as if they were the people who were living there, not the people who were invading the region. In reality, there is a little bit of a complexity about that. That some of the historians were not actually from, say, Syria and Egypt. They came, like Al-Khatib al-Isfahani, who was the secretary of Saladin. He came from Isfahan. He's not a local person. But when he wrote history, he wrote as if the Crusaders came and invaded us. So that is something that you see in terms of the Crusades seen from the Arabs as something that came from outside. It is, as Jim said, it is another chapter of different things. You know, there are, the period saw lots of encroachments into this period, into this geography. It wasn't simply the Crusaders. At some points, the Muslims were having battles with the Byzantines. A couple of decades before, you have the Seljuks coming and invading greater Syria and challenging Egypt. So the period was in transformation. And the Muslims were commenting on lots of things that were happening around them, and not only the Crusades or the Crusaders. And that is a major distinction. Let me go back and rephrase it. When we want to look at the Islamic history of the Crusader period, we need to look at the history of a geography and what was happening there from the, or as the Muslims saw the important things that happening there. And therefore, the Crusades were not the most important thing. They were a serious challenge, but they were one of several important things that were unfolding. And the Muslim historians and religious scholars were trying to struggle with all of the struggle, all of these transformation together, rather than at one thing at a time. If you look at Crusader history from European perspective, it's largely a series of campaigns that were tied to varieties of geographies. At one point, European history decided that they want to zoom only on the encounter with the Muslims. There is a revisionist historiography of the Crusades today that tries to see the Crusader phenomena as varieties of campaigns into different geographies, including against the Byzantines, including parts of Western Europe, and then later on Central and Eastern Europe. So they start looking at it again from the perspective of the totality of it rather than from one angle of it. So I think Jim must have thought of something, so I'm going to stop here.
Yeah. I would agree with everything that Suleiman has said. And I think one of the things that we're trying to open up a little bit is, you know, professional Crusades historians know that the Crusades are more than from Urban's sermon in 1095 until the fall of the last outpost in 1291 along the Syrian coast. Nowadays historians know that what we call the Crusader enterprise is much larger. It includes Spain, it includes North Africa, it includes Sicily, southern Italy, but it still is focused on the Eastern Mediterranean primarily. And so our sources are primarily Eastern Mediterranean sources, but even there we're trying to introduce the reader to a world that is not just thinking of this period from, you know, the late 1000s to the late 1200s as the only thing that matters in this part of the world. The world, you know, people continue to live. Day-to-day life continues to go on. Interactions between local Muslims, Christians, and Jews are continuing on, but also interactions between Muslim rulers, notables in cities, villagers, with the Franks who have come, some who have settled, some who are coming new and haven't accommodated themselves. So we're trying to bring these kinds of things to light with as many different kinds of sources as possible. But I think one of the key things that both of, I know both Suleiman and I emphasize in our class, is that what we call the Crusades in the West are not, that's not how it's perceived by the people who are being, who are facing this new invasion or this new military encounter that begins in the late 1000s. It's not something that just started out of the blue, but this is part of a very long process that has been going on since the early 600s.
In other words, they don't really draw a clear distinction between these crusaders from Western Europe and the other Christians they were fighting in Byzantium or campaigns in Spain and Sicily. There's not so much of a clear division between those.
No, I think it's generally conceived of as all of a piece. Yeah.
And we shouldn't forget that we are talking about specific educated intelligentsia scholars, who have been morphed into or whose understanding of Islamic history is largely similar, and who look at the history with that kind of continuity, that there is a world of Islam, there is a world of Christianity. And there has been period, obviously, of long peaces between the two, but there have been lots of wars between the two. So yes, a lot of the sources that we deal with don't make the distinction. Actually, if we look at Ibn al-Athir, for instance, he tells it very clearly that, it's not that the Crusaders appeared in 1097. This started way back in Spain and the conquest of Sicily, and other parts. So only now that they are showing in the Eastern Mediterranean. So he makes that kind of connection. And to complement what Jim just said, is it's very important as well that when we think of the question of how Islamic history of the period is different, or how scholars were thinking of that period in a little bit in a different, is that most of them were thinking of it in the broader context of Islamic history from beginning till the end. They don't mean the end at their time, the end in terms of future, the end of time. So there is that continuum that lots of religious scholars, Muslim religious scholars, have in mind when they think about history. There is a beginning, there is an end, there is their time, and they try to struggle to make sense of it all and how things fit as puzzles into that kind of a broad scheme. And that's very important for us to read when we read Crusader history, so that we understand really what these Muslim historians, religious scholars, jurists, geographers were trying to achieve.
Well, that actually is a great point that segues directly into the next question I was going to ask. You're talking about how they're organizing things. And my question now to the both of you is about your organization. You have divided the anthology into sections, some of which you just mentioned. There are six sections. The first is travel literature and geographical guides. Then there's jihad books and juridical directives, followed by chronicles, memoirs, and poetry, biographies, correspondences, treaties and truces, and finally inscriptions. So you're trying to put together a picture from the Muslim perspective of this period in history. Why these categories? How did you select the categories? Were others maybe considered and rejected? I'd love to hear just kind of about your organizational principles.
Okay. I'm going to use your question to follow up on what Suleiman was just talking about on this broader conception of Islamic history.
Yes, please.
And our first chapter, Travel Literature and Geographical Guides, gets to that as well. Because just as in the Jewish tradition and in the Christian tradition, the history of the people of Israel begins with Adam and Eve. The history of Christianity begins with Adam and Eve. The history of Islam begins with Adam and Eve as well. And in the text that we included in the travel literature and geographical guides, there's, you know, descriptions of these sacred spaces in the Eastern Mediterranean, most, you know, in the Holy Land writ large, that are shared places of sanctity among all three traditions. And so obviously the authors here are Muslim authors, so they're focusing primarily on their interpretation of these sites, but they're not exclusively only Islamic sites. They know that Christians are there. They know that, I mean, that Christians venerate them or that Jews venerate them. And by including these texts here at the very beginning of the anthology, we're trying to set the tone for introducing the reader to this larger world of, you know, there's a variety of monotheistic communities that are sharing this space and seeing it in similar ways, but also in uniquely different ways. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do in that opening chapter. And I'll turn it over to Suleiman now.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Jim, for that. That's exactly, you know, we talked a lot about these categories and how to divide them and went back and forth in terms of arranging them, putting one before the other, etc. And finally, we settled on this precisely along the line that Jim said, because when, again, the stereotypical understanding of the Crusades is that here you have the Crusaders who came, conquered Jerusalem, committed a huge massacre, killing 70,000 Muslims, and took Jerusalem away from the Muslims. And ever since, the Muslims are trying to take it away. So as if Jerusalem was the reason for warfare. I'm not saying Jerusalem was not a reason for warfare, but one, we need to probably be a little bit humble in the way we assert certain things. And that's why Al-Harawi, for instance, tells us very stunning things about when he traveled. He traveled at the time when the Crusaders were in charge of Jerusalem. He went there, prayed at the Temple Mount, and described what the Crusaders actually did to the place. And he goes all the way to Hebron. And in Hebron, he sits with a Crusader knight, an old Crusader knight, and they reminisce about the patriarchs, about Abraham, Sarah. And that Crusader guy, when he was a kid, he went down and helped rebuild the sanctuary, because at one point it seems it has collapsed. So he was there. And Al-Harawi tells us that actually he found that discussion with the Crusader knight an extremely revealing on the one hand. But more importantly, he says that now I have seen someone who saw Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in life, not in a dream. That is, he saw them dead, but he saw their corpses. Because all his life, Al-Harawi have heard about these patriarchs, but either people have told him about them in books or about dreams they have seen them, but never in reality. So there you see the world that actually both, and by extension Judaism as well, the three communities share, that at some point they fought over it, at other points they sat down and realized that they all have the same history, the same religious dogma in as relating to the patriarchs in one way or another. They all revere similar geography, similar personalities. It wasn't always animosity, and they settled things through war. Sometimes they settled things through friendships, oftentimes they converged to the same spaces, not to worship together, but to worship in the same place, each community. That tells you about the common that at least they realize they have. So it's very important to set the tone that it wasn't a period of bloodshed. And one shouldn't go all the way to the other side to say that there was no bloodshed. Actually, there was a lot of it. But it was a much more complex period. And you look at the geography. Also, geography tells you about how these Muslim scholars identified the importance of many places. And that also puts you or gives you that kind of realization that they didn't look at it as black and white. They often looked at it as shades, complex shades. Ibn Jubayr tells us about this church that used to be a mosque where Muslims go to worship, and the Crusaders are also there, but they are in a different corner and also they worship. So again, plenty of this kind of material that witness some kind of coexistence that was present. And you have that from the perspective of Muslim sources in a very clear way, not tangential way or not speculative way. It's a very clear way that complicates, again, our understanding. And that goes into the different categories of the other books that we have, that it's important to look at the varieties of what the Muslims produce at the time in order to, again, directly or indirectly talk to that challenge that we call the Crusader invasion. So what, how they redefined, for instance, jihad ideology, what type of fatwas they issued that speak about relationships with the Crusaders. And the most important feature of Islamic historiography that often doesn't get consulted is the art of biographical dictionary, which is a form of history. Although it might be a little bit of a praise of a certain figure for the most part, especially rulers. But that also, you know, talks about them, what they contributed, how their author, the authors of those biographies saw that person achieve certain political, religious objectives. So it's very important when you study the Crusader period to see how Muslims thought of Nuruddin, for instance, who was probably the most important Muslim political leader of the period, definitely of the 12th century, much more important than Saladin. And then you read his biography and realize that the biography is not obsessed with Nuruddin's relation with the Crusades or wars with the Crusades. It contextualizes, again, Islamic history in a broad geography with many concerns. And that is very important for the student of Crusader history to realize. So that, that's essentially the idea behind this kind of division, is that it gives you not a saturated, because in final analysis, we have a limited number of words that we can do. That's always a challenge for publishing a book. But you can give the student an ability to zoom on a genre of literature and get to appreciate how Crusader period is told through that genre. So through biographical dictionaries, through geography, through jihad books, through chronicles, and above all, through two other things that are not always part of the story, inscriptions, you know, how people went around dedicating inscriptions for mosques, for castles, for things of that type, or correspondence, theses, and truths that often get buried in our understanding of that period, because often it exposes much more complex world than the simple narrative that we want to tell.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think one of the things that's so successful about it is that you do include a whole bunch of different perspectives, even within those categories. Like right in the middle of the second chapter of the Jihad Books and Juridical Directives, you have a translation of Ibn Taymiyyah's directive against the Shia, which is, you know, it kind of goes to serve the point that this was not unified Christians versus unified Muslims, but that even within each community, I guess this is highlighting the Muslim community, that there's still significant division within the community.
Absolutely. And if you see why Ibn Taymiyyah, it's not the only reason, but one of the reasons he's angry against the Shiites is because he considered them to be collaborators with the Crusaders. So that adds to what you just said, Ari.
Yes.
About the complexity That's not one group against another group. It's much more complex, at least the way some people imagine.
And not only collaborators with the Crusaders, but also with the Mongols. So, I mean, the sort of in his day, those are the two external powers that are pressing on the area. And, you know, he kind of ties them both in there together. And the Shia are the bad guys for him. Well, another thing that we in that first chapter, Suleiman had brought up Ibn Jubair's, some of his discussions. And he's from Valencia. He's from Spain. So he's from the Western Mediterranean. He's come here. And in his descriptions of the city of Acre and the city of Tyre, I mean, the headings in his texts are, you know, the city of Tyre, may God destroy it. The city of Acre, may God destroy it and restore it to the Muslims. Even though he's talking about interactions and they seem to be, you know, he describes a Christian wedding that he observes, and he's a wonderful testifier to what he has seen. He still needs, he's still, as the outsider who has not gotten used to the Franks here in this part of the world, like some of the other authors who have interacted with them, he still wants to restore the world to the way that it's supposed to be with you know, his version of Islam in charge, which is, again, which takes us back to Ibn Taymiyyah, who is, you know, his Sunni supremacism is very much on parade in that fatwa. That the natural order of things is that the Sunnis must be in charge. Anything that upsets that, you know, he doesn't like. And I don't know if I would enjoy spending time with Ibn Taymiyyah, but I enjoy reading him because there's no nuance in much of what he writes. So it's very easy to teach from. You know, he's very clear in what he wants to communicate.
Absolutely.
Which I think is fun for students when they encounter that, because many of our students are a little bit more reluctant to actually articulate what is going on in their own minds, because they don't want to step on anybody's toes. The authors that we're translating here, they didn't mind stepping on people's toes, because that was rhetorically acceptable at that time.
Stomping on people's toes,
which is another. Right, which is another way of entering, you know, getting the students to enter into a world that's very different from their own, and to understand it on its own terms and not to impose our expectations of what's normal on the past.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Yeah. But another thing, you brought up the jihad things. One of the fatwas that we include in there is a fatwa against selling arms to the Franks. Okay, so he's not going to issue a declaration that you should not sell arms to the Franks if people are not selling arms to the Franks.
Of course.
So it gives you an insight into the right there on that economic interaction that is existing in the Eastern Mediterranean at that time.
So some author. And, go ahead.
And if I add one last thing.
Yeah.
We try to add a lot, to include a lot of poetry. Because often poetry echoes a lot of feelings, poetry was, as many scholars, when I was a student, used to say, it was a newspaper of the time. That when you want to write something and disseminate it in the fastest possible way, you do it in the medium of poetry. So poetry was very important at the time. There's plenty of poetry that is very relevant. And unfortunately, lots of scholars keep poetry aside because it's hard to translate. So we try to struggle with many poems in order to translate them precisely to give the student and the scholars who are interested access to that world from all its perspective. And poetry is extremely important.
Well, thank you for that, because I can attest that poetry is extremely difficult to translate. Some authors in here feature quite prominently, Ibn Asakir, my own personal favorite, Ibn al-Athir, Ibn Wasil, Sibtimid al-Jawzi. These are obviously the big names, and they kind of, their sources come back again and again. You return back again and again to them. Who would you say is maybe a lesser known source, that you have in here, who you feel provides value to non-Arabic speaking students and scholars of the Crusades?
Well, I'm going to pick up on the poetry.
Yes, please.
We included Kaiserani's poems about Frankish and Greek women in Antioch, and it illustrates the importance of poetry, but it also illustrates that it does not matter the time period, the culture that a man may come from. They invariably have the same response to beautiful women. He's captivated by these women, and he's just extolling their beauty and comparing them to the icons that he would see in a church. And just as the Christians would, prostrate themselves and venerate the icon, these women are the ones who should be prostrated before and venerated because of their beauty. So we include, those poems. They're standalone poems, but they're a window on a Muslim, poet's reaction to the outsider women. And it's not, he probably should not be saying these things. I'm sure his wife, if he were to recite this poem to his wife, she wouldn't be happy about it. But it's a very nice insight into the human condition, that this is his response to seeing the beauty of the foreigner there. That's just one small example that I think illustrates things quite nicely for us.
Mm-hmm.
For me, there are a few historians that we don't pay attention to a lot. One of them actually is a great Abu Shama. His book on the 13th century hasn't received the serious attention that it should receive. This is a very important historian. Often we only look at his Kitab al-Rawdatayn because, again, he wrote it about Nur al-Din and Saladin. But his history of his own period, largely the 13th century up till 1260s, is largely not as much used in Crusader scholarship. So we are trying to pay attention to Abu Shama in some ways. There is another one who comes, again, it's middle of the 14th century, Anwar al-Iskandarani. But that is because nobody looks at him, because we assume 1291 is the end of the Crusades, when actually the Crusaders were still around. And people in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Muslims in Egypt and Greater Syria, were still concerned about attacks by Crusaders from varieties of islands. And Nuwayr al-Iskandarani tells us about the attack against the major sack of Alexandria in 1365. So we try to pay attention to some of these marginalized historians who are very important and who speak also about the period. So aside from the usual suspects, you have that. But what we also did is that in few cases, we decided to give more than one narrative about a specific incident. So let me just illustrate with the case of Damascus. We have two different, clearly different stories about what happened when the Crusaders, the Second Crusade, attacked Damascus in 1148. There is one by a local scholar called Ibn al-Qalanisi, and there is another one by Ibn al-Athir. And you read them, and you get completely different conclusions about that. And it's very important for the student, when they read Muslim sources about the Crusader period, that they should look for different historians and what they all say, rather than pick up one narrative and they say that what happened. Actually, of the two, from my own judgment, and that something came up in the discussions that we had with Jim as we were translating them and commenting on them, is that Ibn al-Qalanisi clearly is trying to exaggerate a lot of details, whereas likely Ibn al-Athir is more down to earth in terms of his narrative. But that's my judgment as a historian. Nevertheless, it's very important for the student to look at more than one narrative, the same way with the capture of Jerusalem, the same way with how, for instance, the Muslims engaged the Third Crusade, so the Battle of Hattin, things of that type. Look at it from different historical perspective. What Ibn al-Athir said what Al-Katib al-Isfahani said, what Abu Shama said, because they got their information not always from the same sources. And that nuances a lot the narrative and helps us understand where certain historians try to exaggerate, try to praise, try to use more what you call the stage of history in order to sing the praise of a specific leader versus actually telling us what really unfolded in an event.
So,
and that's extremely important.
So what do you think accounts for the fact that sources like Al-Nuwayri, Al-Iskandarani, and Abu Shama are kind of ignored, while, you know, the big names, you know, Sibt, Ibn al-Jawzi, and Dhahabi, and Ibn al-Sakir, and Ibn al-Athir, their popularity has proliferated. Why these and not those?
You know, the biggest factor is availability in English. So now Ibn al-Athir is available in English. Everybody is able to read Ibn al-Athir. Al-Iskandarani, Nuwayr al-Iskandarani is only in Arabic, so only scholars who know Arabic can access it. But also what adds to that is a factor that some scholars, some historians, medieval historians, become a fad, so to speak. So at one point, Ibn Asakir was discovered. Lots of studies started to come around Ibn Asakir, created a kind of tremendous interest with domino effect. So everybody started, Ibn Asakir, I can might find interesting information in him. So everybody started to go to Ibn Asakir and the like. So you end up actually for easy access, because the path has already been trodden, it makes it easier for scholars to pursue specific suspects than to go and broach some historian who has never been studied before. Abu Shama, for instance, his Tarajim, which is a continuation of Kitab al-Rawdatayn, it's called Zayl also, which is a combination of historical, chronicle, and also short biographical dictionary, is extremely rich. But again, you need the first great name scholar to dig into Abu Shama and excites everybody so that Abu Shama becomes the go-to person. It's not yet the case. So that's often, in my opinion, some of the factors that determine why certain people are more popular than other people in terms of our use of them in the way we write the history of the Crusader period.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and I will follow up on that. I mean, Al-Nuwayri, whose text that we include in here on the sack of Cyprus's sack of Alexandria, which is very vivid and full of, it's kind of captivating, but we don't really know much about him. We have his text, and as Suleiman said, it's available in Arabic, so it's a lot of work to get to it. Hopefully, this will, you know, encourage people to look into it a little bit more. There are two. We also included two texts by Kalkashandi, which are sort of diplomatic texts. One of them is an account of, you know, Saladin's letter to Baldwin now on the death of his father, and it's a very touching letter, you know, at the loss of a friend. Okay, as he's writing to his, you know, his boy successor, who's a boy king. Mm-hmm. And the other one that we included by him is an account of oaths of truce between the Mamluk Sultan Kalaun and the Franks of Akko, Sidon, and Atlit. And it's very insightful on, you know, format and the kinds of things that are sworn to in these oaths. But it's also gives you, when you read the you know, Kalaun's account or his oaths, the things that he is appealing to, you know, to God, to the Quran, to the sort of the important things to Islam. And then when you read the ones that are being sworn by the Christian rulers, you know, they're appealing to the Messiah, to the cross, to the Trinity, to events of biblical history that are important to, if I swear by these things, I'm going to follow through on what I say. Mm-hmm. So both of those are texts that are not commonly found in sort of anthologies or things that you discuss about the Crusades, but they give really nice insight into, you know, the worldview and the value system of important actors in this time period. So I think that those are two other, I don't want to say minor examples because we think they're all major, but, you know, less well-known examples of what we include.
So one of the things that I noticed, and this ties into what you were both saying about trying to give multiple perspectives on things, you included what I like to call dueling biographies, a couple of them. One was on the Ayyubid ruler Al-Muazzam. You had one by Sibt ibn al-Jawzi and another by al-Dhahabi, and another biography, a set of biographies on Ya'qub ibn Siklab, who was a Christian physician, one of them by Ibn Abi Usaybiyah and, again, Sibt ibn al-Jawzi. So why did you choose those two? I'm sure you could have found any number of figures to find different perspectives on. Was there something about Al-Mu'azzam or this Christian physician Ya'qub that you thought was kind of a good demonstration of different perspectives?
I'll let Suleiman go first on that one.
Yeah. Al-Mu'azzam, again, we try to give a good representation for the 13th century, which gets often obfuscated, especially the first part of the 13th century. You have the climax in terms of modern Crusader historiography and interest. You have a tremendous interest in the Third Crusade, and there is a huge jump almost to to a large extent, to Louis, Saint Louis in 1249, 1250, but more interestingly toward the end, 1291. And you feel that the 13th century is, the scholars of Crusades really are not really interested in it. They already have decided that the Crusader project is tittering and about to fall apart. And that's why we picked a lot of examples, including the biography of Al-Mu'azzam, because Al-Mu'azzam was a major figure in greater Syria at the beginning of the 13th century. The reason we didn't do proper work in terms of dual biography, because we don't want to bore the reader, but we highlighted elements, especially using Zahabi, where his biography of the same person, either Al-Mu'azzam or the physician Ya'qub ibn Siklab, featured something tremendously different from the other biography, which he also was aware of. And that helps us as scholars, and that goes back to a point that we try to make, Jim and I, is that it's very important as student of history that we ask the question, what is the objective, what is the interest of a chronicler, of a scholar, to be reporting something like that? Right? So what is the interest of Sibt ibn al-Jawzi to be writing a biography about his political patron, Al-Mu'azzam? Right? So it's not to read it and say, this is what Sibt wrote, therefore it must be correct history. I don't know. As a historian, it's very hard for me to determine if it is exact, correct history. But what I can determine, and that would be more interesting, is to get into the world of Sibt ibn al-Jawzi, why he decided to write the biography in the way he wrote it. And the only way I can determine that, if I look at another biography of Al-Mu'azzam, to see, did he take things out? Did he include things that the other biography didn't include? And that was the logic behind including one full biography from a source and selections from another biography in order to highlight that actually these authors were also makers of history. They were not simply reporters of history. They were trying to channel historical information about specific people in certain way. In this way, it is essentially an acknowledgement about the uniqueness of Al-Mu'azzam by Sibt ibn al-Jawzi. Al-Dhahabi didn't know Al-Mu'azzam, didn't care much about Al-Mu'azzam's place in history. So he commented to us that Al-Mu'azzam used to drink a lot of alcohol, which is a detail that Sibt ibn al-Jawzi decided to leave out, right? And it's very important for a Muslim audience to realize that a lot of biographies of Muslim people have been written with an eye about their legacy, how you are going to shape their legacy, positively or negatively, which brings the authors and actually makes them more like actors than simple passive reporters of information. And again, the best way to achieve this objective is by giving more than one narrative about the same person or the same event, and allow the student, allow the reader to discover it on their own, rather than tell them, trust me, it's much more complicated than that. No, give them the information and let them, like you, like me, reach the same conclusion through looking at the evidence.
Well, I think that is a great place to stop because we're actually running up against our time limit. I want to thank you both so much. This has been really great. The book is incredibly useful. Before we sign off, would you mind sharing with us what you're working on now? I mean, you're just in the process of finishing this big project, so maybe it's a little premature to talk about the next project, but if there is one.
Well, there is one.
All right. No rest for the weary.
Suleiman and I have found that working together is not only enjoyable, but we learn a lot. And I think we've talked about this at length among ourselves, that it's if you do the monkish approach to scholarship and it's just you by yourself, you learn a great deal. But there are so many things that I've come up with that I bounced the eye off of Suleiman that what he brings to that conversation, he points out that, well, you didn't quite get that right, but what about this? And then you have that back and forth and you end up with a much stronger product at the end. So that's been a great deal of fun. But what the project that we're starting to embark on now is another translation project that we are going to be doing. We're tentatively calling it Biblical Messengers in Islam. And we'll be translating biographies of major biblical characters from Ibn Issachar's History of Damascus. And again, it'll be modeled on the format that we used in this book so that we'll have study questions and contextualizing essays so that it can be used in classes on, Bible or comparative religion or Islamic religious ideas. And so that's going to be a great deal of fun as well. That's what we're working on.
Well, that's
getting started working on.
That sounds great. I could use that right now. If you guys could, kick up the pace a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I can't, we both could use it as well. you want to add to that?
My only thing is that we have identified 10 personalities, 6 men and 4 women, because it's very important to realize that when we talk of biblical messengers and biblical prophets, from the Islamic perspective, they include both men and women. And I know in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we don't use the word necessarily prophet, but we use the patriarchs and matriarchs. So in the Islamic tradition, often they are addressed all collectively as messengers. And it's very important to give that kind of complexity that someone like Ibn Asakir, when he thought of the biblical period, he thought of the likes of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and David and Solomon, but also of Eve and Sarah and so many other, Mary and so many other women figures whom he considered as messengers, because in one way or another, they came to either deliver or fulfill some kind of a divine duty,
okay,
which is part of Islamic history, how we perceive it.
Yeah, the way we're conceiving of it now, and again, this is the very beginning, so who knows what it's going to end up as. I mean, you've written, Ari, you know how that works. But we're planning on doing Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, David, and Jesus would be the men. And then the women would be Eve, Hagar, Sarah, and then Mary. And all of them are, extremely important for their own reason. And in the Islamic tradition, Abraham, Moses, David, and Jesus are all recipients of scripture. And so they're obviously important, but Adam and Noah are crucially important for you know, for obvious reasons as well. And, you know, Eve is the mother of Adam's sons, Cain, Abel, and Seth. Hagar is the mother of Abraham's first son, Ishmael. Sarah is the mother of the second son, Isaac. And then, of course, Mary is as the mother of Jesus. So we think that by addressing these characters, and there are many more in the Islamic biblical characters in the Islamic tradition that Ibn Issachar includes, but this is where we're starting with this project. And, you know, in a volume about the size of this book is what we're anticipating, so that you could assign it very easily in a class. And that's what we're hoping. That's what we're working on now.
Oh, that sounds really great. Listen, this has been a fantastic discussion. Thank you both so much again for coming on the podcast. I wish you luck on the new project. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Aris, for having us. Thank you.
Absolutely. Take care, guys.